I don't know if we have a quorum yet, but I'm going to go through the whole list with everybody.
Great, thank you.
Certainly. Hero?
Yes.
Arnell?
Yes.
Bagai?
Yes.
Beanstalk?
Yes.
Blazik? Brady?
Yes.
And Snell.
I'm here.
This is Christensen. I didn't hear my name called, but I am here.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you, Sherry. So we do have a quorum. Thank you, everybody, for being here. A couple quick points before we get started. 1602 is in front of Governor Hobbs right now, and if Ryan, if you're on, you can jump in. But from my understanding, tomorrow is the deadline for her to sign or veto or do nothing. If she signs it, it's in law. If she does nothing, it's in law. And part of the effect to this committee is there's a deadline of September 1st. That we have to provide feedback to the dental board so the dental board can institute new rules based off of these recommendations. We only have today and one more meeting scheduled before that time. So I'm not going to allow any comments or questions by non-committee members. The only exception to that will be we asked Dr. Caputo to do some work for the committee. If there's questions specifically related to that task, he'll be able to speak. Otherwise, you know, we're going to keep it just to the committee members in an effort to try to expedite these meetings so we can ensure that we hit this deadline. Ryan, did you want to add anything on that?
No, you said that you got everything correct.
Great.
But I can answer any questions if anybody has any.
Ryan, I think it would be good to circulate you know, via staff, the current language of 1602 that is probably going to go into law, if you can circulate that with the committee.
Yeah, I'll send a link for what likely will be the chapter version of 1602. I'll have somebody send a link. It'll either be Yasmin or Sherry.
Great, thank you.
Do you want me to now?
What's that?
Do you want that now, or do you want is it after the meeting? Okay.
If staff can do it now, I would do it now.
Okay.
I think the most important part is frankly going to be Jessica cross referencing the rule changes we're making with this new statute to make sure that there's no conflictions, but. You know, I'm sure the committee is going to want to review that as well. Okay, then moving along, I'll make a motion to approve the open session minutes from May 30th.
I'll second it, Lyle.
Motion and a second. Discussion. If you want to, all in favor, just raise your hand with the little link. Great.
Hey guys, I'm on board too.
And that's Dr. Brady. Thanks, Dr. Brady.
Thank you.
And anybody, if you can put your hands down, and then if anybody's opposed, raise it. Dr. Lout, I'm guessing you're opposed.
No, I'm not opposed. I just pushed the wrong button. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm for it.
That's what I mean. I meant to say I'm guessing you're not opposed to it.
No.
Okay, motion passes, none opposed. So moving on to NPR, where we stopped. Jessica, are you on with us? Ryan or staff, do we know if Jessica's on?
So she sent an email saying that she has this on her calendar. Christina just sent me a text message that she's trying to get in contact with Jessica right now. So I'm not, let me look and see what else is on the agenda. I don't see her on though right now.
Well, while we're waiting to not waste time, why don't we jump to agenda item 5, adverse occurrence policy and procedure? Because I think that and where we are right now in rule are probably the two most substantive agenda items that we want to get through before the deadline. Dr. Arnell, you got your hand up.
Yes. Eddie and Anthony and I were tasked with reviewing the adverse occurrence reporting system, and we emailed out what we worked on to Yasmin, but I haven't seen that it's been sent out to anybody yet. Did that get sent out to everybody on the committee?
Can you confirm what day you sent that to me? I don't recall receiving anything.
I can look back in my email here.
Okay.
Can...
Do you want to give us the highlights of it, and then we can just have it resent out when you find it?
Sure, if you'd like.
Yeah, let's do that.
So we, as a committee, we approached it with three goals in mind. We wanted to first increase patient safety. Second, make the reporting system efficient and intuitive for the licensee and for BODEX to use. And third, we wanted to make the review of these reports as equitable as possible. So we looked at the current language for incident reports, and then rewrote the language with some edits to what we felt would match those three goals. So if you'd like, I can read the current language and then read the proposed language, or how would you like me?
Hey, Matt, Anthony, can I just chime in real quick? There's an email from Yasmin on May 30th that includes that subcommittee's document. If you guys can open your emails, it's there.
Oh, great.
May 29th, Arnell. Yasmin,
okay, that's great. I didn't realize it had been sent out. Is there any way that we can put that on the screen?
Right now. I'll try to do it.
Thank you for doing that, Yasmin. I wasn't aware that it had been sent out. I was trying to find that myself.
Well, while they're working on that, Matt, just why don't you go through, I mean, and I'm looking at the document, current language and proposed language, just kind of go through it for us.
Okay. So the current language says, if a death or incident requiring emergency medical response occurs in a dental office or dental clinic during the administration of or recovery from general anesthesia, deep sedation, moderate sedation, or minimal sedation, the permit holder and the treating dentist involved shall submit a complete report of the incident to the board within 10 days after the occurrence. So then our proposed language says, if a death or incident involving the activation of emergency medical response with hospital admission occurs in the dental office or dental clinic during the administration of recovery from minimal, moderate, or deep sedation or general anesthesia, the permit holder shall submit an Article 13 incident report, and then in parentheses with a link to that report, to the board within 7 business days following the incident.
Okay, and Matt, let me read the current language in 1602 just so we make sure everything is cohesive.
Okay.
It says, if a death or incident requiring emergency medical response occurs in a dental office or dental clinic during the administration of or recovery from general anesthesia or sedation by a certified registered, this is a, it says nurse anesthetist, but it'd be, you know, by the permit holder. Person may report the death or incident to the board within 7 business days after the occurrence. So, I guess my first question would be, with the added language of hospital admission, do we think that that still is cohesive with what's stated in statute?
We spoke at length on this issue, because we realized, you know, no matter what we wrote, 1602, if it is written into law, if it's codified, then we'll need what we write to match. So if that language is written, then of course we would need to edit it to not say, with hospital admission, but simply to say the activation of emergency medical response. Then, but we did also later on in the document address, a way to comply with 1602, but still handle it in the spirit of what we're trying to do.
Okay. Why don't we talk about that?
Okay. So, 1602 doesn't say anything at all about what is done with that report or how to make the report or what the report is. It just says that it must be reported. And the way that it's written, it says that it must be reported if EMS is activated or, you know, whatever the exact language is. In essence, it's if EMS is activated, there must be a report. So currently, when that happens, the report is called an adverse outcome or adverse occurrence report. And it's found on the dental board website, but there's no clear link to it. And what we wanted to do was first we created a new form that's actually tied to the Article 13. It's called an Article 13 incident report as opposed to an adverse occurrence. And we give the link directly to it. So when somebody needs to make a report, when they go to the Article 13 incident report, one of the first things on the incident report itself is a checklist. And it asks the question, was EMS activated? Was the patient transported? Was the patient admitted to the hospital? Did the patient die? In essence, it asks those 4 questions. Then 1602 doesn't say what we must do with that report, just that it is simply reported, right? So as in our subcommittee, we decided that if the report was received and it was simply that EMS was activated but the patient wasn't transported, or that EMS was activated and the patient was transported but not admitted, it was well within the board's purview to say under those 2 circumstances, the report is received and that's the end, no investigation. But in the case that the patient was admitted to the hospital or the patient died, then it would trigger, you know, a chain of events to gather information for that report. So we felt that would be a simple way to comply with 1602, but also be in line with the spirit of what we're trying to accomplish here. And actually probably would be a really nice thing. We would, in those cases, gather data, but not put the licensee through a full investigation in the event that a patient was, or an event was reported, but the patient wasn't admitted or didn't die. So anyway, getting back to what we proposed, first, you know, the licensee would fill out the Article 13 incident report. And then we proposed a system for how that report is handled. So if you scroll down, on what's shown on the screen here, Ryan, if you wouldn't mind scrolling down what's shown on the screen here. Let's see, right there. Yep. So, this is what we proposed happens with that Article 13 incident report. first that standing anesthesia committee, is appointed by BODEX that receives the report from board staff, and the anesthesia committee reviews the report and determines if it merits further investigation. Then one of two things happens. If no further investigation is merited, then the anesthesia committee provides a response to BODEX that notifies the licensee that the report is closed and may give, you know, some recommendations or comments to the provider based on what the committee saw. And then if it's a non-dental anesthesia provider, then that can be passed on to their governing board. And of course, whatever the anesthesia committee decides, BODEX is the ultimate authority and they can choose to accept or reject the recommendation from the anesthesia committee. But we felt that this was a better way to handle these reports, so that these reports are handled by a committee of anesthesia professionals, you know, from each of the specialties, and as opposed to being handled directly by the dental board. But in the end, the dental board does have the power to accept or reject whatever recommendations are made by the anesthesia committee. So the anesthesia committee isn't necessarily the deciding entity. It just gives recommendations to the dental board.
And in the event that an adverse occur, in an event that EMS is activated and the patient is not admitted to the hospital, can the committee and or BODEX still investigate and decide to dismiss?
Yes. So the anesthesia committee, in the event that the patient isn't admitted, the anesthesia committee, the idea is that they generally don't do a further investigation. However, if they see something that they feel warrants a further investigation, they can give that recommendation to BODEX. And if BODEX feels the same way or even disagrees with the anesthesia committee, they can, of course, further investigate. Then if we go down, if you scroll down there a little bit, Ryan, to number three. Let's see. Number three talks about in the instances where the anesthesia committee does feel that it merits further investigation, then it passes on its recommendations to BODEX in a letter that's sent to the licensee or the non-dental anesthesia provider's governing board, and advises them that further investigation is required. And then from there, BODEX determines the appropriate response. And that could be that BODEX says, you know, answers back to the committee and says, go ahead and do a further investigation, or that BODEX refers it to an independent investigator, or that they decide to do it themselves. Whatever BODEX decides, of course, is the ultimate decision, but the anesthesia committee is there as a group of peers who could be used for that further investigation.
Great. Thank you. I've got a question. Ryan, this is first for you. I think, you know, the idea of this committee or a similar committee being a standing committee, I think most of the members here agree with that. With this language being written, as it stands, can we make that recommendation to BODEX prior to this committee becoming a standing committee? I'm kind of stumbling through that question, but I think you probably know where I'm going with it, Ryan.
Yeah. This is Seamus. I just wanted to point out that one consideration that you're going to want to take.
First, Seamus, welcome back. It's great to have you.
Thank you. The wet blanket is back to ruin your day. And thank you for that. I'm glad to be back. Very excited. The one thing that I would take into consideration, though, is that the investigative committee is the one who handles the majority of the recommendations regarding potential cases of disciplinary action or those that don't warrant disciplinary action. So, I think it would be important just to remember you have that committee and not circumvent, its authority and the expertise that's on that authority already.
On the investigative committee.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because we do have two oral surgeons and two anesthesiologists, I believe, on that committee. Okay, but Dr. Snell, you've had your hand up, but I don't know if that was from your previous comment or not.
All right, that was probably from my previous comment. Getting taken off.
Dr. Caputo.
I just wanted to clarify your question to Matt. The current language, the way it's written, there are only two triggers for a incident report. One would be a death, and the other would be EMS transport with admission. So to your question about would there be an investigation if there wasn't an admission, the answer is no, based on the proposed language. So there's some recommendations further down that Matt may be getting to, but that's going to be up to the committee decide is what direction you want to go for the triggers.
I think the way Dr. Arnau was answering that was before that question, I had asked him about the current language in 1602 does not specify about a hospital admission.
Correct.
So in that case, he had said these rules would be the recommendation in here would have to be edited to take out the hospital admission.
Correct. Just making sure that was clear.
Yeah. Thank you. Dr. Christensen, I know you were part of this. Did you want to add anything?
I think it was very well stated. It was great to work with Dr. Caputo and Dr. Arnau, and I thought Dr. Arnau did a great job laying that out. There might be some tweak language, as Dr. Caputo stated. I think one other thing that kind of flushed out as well is what is the difference with an incident report and an adverse outcome report? And I think they need to be differentiated. And this could come down the line, but I think the adverse outcomes that we looked at, 2 years ago should be reviewed by committee so that we can actually have an accurate reporting system, because several of those I would not list as an adverse outcome, only as an incident report. Thank you.
Thank you. And I agree. I think that's an important distinction. Ryan or Seamus, would it be appropriate at this point to vote on adopting this language as part of the recommendation from this committee to the dental board?
Yeah, I mean, if this is what you want, I'll just give you my two cents. I would be more, and I don't know if it was Dr. Caputo or Seamus that said it, I would be more in favor of keeping the investigation committee to look at these as opposed to holding this committee. I would have to look at 1602, but I think 1602 almost dissolves the ANS committee because they want everything finalized by this committee. And we, in order to continue the committee, I think in perpetuity, we would have to run legislation to add this to your statutory authority as well. So that would be my only request on an amendment to it.
And that could always be discussed in a BODEX meeting as well, correct?
Sure.
Dr. Arnell.
So the the reason that we kind of specified an anesthesia committee is the current committee, I'm blanking on the name, the investigative committee. Is that correct?
Yes.
That committee is tasked with investigating complaints of any kind, right? A bad crown margin, a failed denture, extraction of the wrong tooth, all sorts of different things to investigate, right? And I would say that most dentists can have at least something to say on those subjects, but with anesthesia and sedation, it really does need to be a focused group of professionals who truly understand, sedation and anesthesia. I've listened to various meetings, that involve reviewing these kinds of reports. Sometimes it really muddies the waters if people who are in the decision making circle are having to learn on the fly what we're talking about. And I think it also would be really valuable to have an anesthesia provider of every type on, whether we add anesthesia providers to that committee that we're talking about, the investigative committee, or whether we make a separate subcommittee just for anesthesia reports. I think it's important that the pediatric dentist who makes the report has a pediatric dentist on the committee that's reviewing it, and the oral surgeon has an oral surgeon, the anesthesiologist has an anesthesiologist, and so on.
And I do believe, doctor, not to interrupt, but I do believe that is the makeup of the committee. So, if that's something that the board wants to discuss, or a committee thinks that the other committees don't meet those standards, I would actually, probably not disagree, but, I've been in a lot of those meetings, and I thought, Dr. Caputo, he does a lot of anesthesiology with, pediatric patients. So, maybe that's where this conversation could be centered around.
Yeah. And I think frankly, I don't want to spend a lot of time right now talking about this because I think it's something that can be hashed out later. Again, okay. I want to keep pushing us to move along with this deadline, but there are four 1301 permit holders on that committee right now. But the idea of a subcommittee out of that's, frankly, not a bad one as well. Ryan, go ahead.
So the only thing I want to add, and I'll leave a guy, feel free to jump in, because I know you sat in a lot of these stakeholder meetings across the street, but and Dr. Arnold, please don't think that I'm being disparaging or trying to contradict anything that you're saying, because I totally appreciate the comment and I appreciate the review of this, because I think ultimately what I set out at the beginning when I started looking at these adverse occurrence reports, I don't want them to be viewed as complaints. Because I don't want people to feel like if I send something to the board, I'm going to be automatically in trouble. So it should kind of come through in a confidential state until the board dictates that it should be open and investigated further. But in order to fast track it to the board, I think the quickest thing still is to get these in front of the very next meeting as the board meeting. And it can go on a board agenda just like we're doing currently, because we don't have an approved policy right now. We're just putting them on the next available board meeting. And the board is looking at it, and then they're directing staff or the investigators to do the next steps and bring them back. If they think it should be opened, it's opened at that point. Otherwise, they're dismissed right away, and nobody knows, including the public, that anything was filed with the board. And I think for me, and I'm not a professional dentist, but I think for me, that's the best way to keep confidentiality, but also fast track it and get it in front of the board as quick as possible. If anything, if you're going to have an investigative committee, and it sounds like it's Seamus now that is the one that brought this up, then it should go through the investigative committee stage. And we can agendize it that way as well. So where, we can write the agenda so that it is reviewed as an adverse occurrence report. So I don't want to add more to Dr. Caputo's plate on the investigative committee, but I think that they're fully equipped and prepared to handle these cases. And then I'll leave it at that, unless Ali wants to jump in and concur or disagree with what I said.
Then if there's
hey,
no
it's more... Ali. Sorry, I'm on the road, but yeah, no, I didn't disagree with anything that you said, Ryan.
Okay, thanks, Ali. Then I think we should, just to try to wrap this up, vote on accepting this language and moving it in front of the board once the rest of the notice of proposed rulemaking has been also reviewed by this committee. So it doesn't need to be separated out, just rolled in. So I'll make the motion that we adopt this language and include it in the notice of proposed rulemaking changes.
I'll second that.
And as a point of discussion, Ryan, I don't disagree with it going to the investigative committee at all, but I think, you know, we can kind of hash that out at a BODEX meeting.
Yeah, that sounds good. Thanks.
All right. So all in favor, you can raise your hand on the little icon. Opposed. Dr. Beanstalk, Dr. Lout, you're in favor, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
And for the record, can we just name that vote unless we're going to post the video?
You want a roll call?
Well, you don't have to roll call, but just indicate, you know, what the vote was.
The vote was unanimous in favor with no opposed.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Do we have Jessica on?
I'm here. Can you guys hear me?
Great. Thank you for being here.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jessica, I'll kick it back to you. We can go back to agenda item 3 where we stopped off last time.
Give me 1 second to see if I can share the document. Okay. Can you guys see the document?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. And I believe this is where we left off at our last meeting. It was 1304.
Yes, I think that's right.
Dr. Hero?
Yes.
There were some items in 1303 that Dr. Caputo and I discussed offline that I don't know if you want to wait till the end and we can go back and just
no,
go
through. No, I'd start now, and I appreciate you bringing that up, Randy. Thank you. So, Jessica, let's go backwards to the items Dr. Blazek's talking about.
Specifically the area about how an applicant was going to need, I thought we said 20 experiences prior to getting his 1303 permit.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to the committee, Dr. Caputo and I, as well as Dr. Christensen, had some offline conversations, and we all feel pretty confident that to ask an individual right out of school, especially if they were to pursue a 1303 permit, that's an arduous task to obtain 20 IV experiences where you're being observed by a healthcare provider. And when we looked at opportunities for education, there really is only two. And even those opportunities, they're limited in their scope of what you get to experience in terms of an anesthetic procedure, as well as looking at some of the requirements from Texas that have recently been laid out. And I think it was Texas and California. And their requirements are really only, you know, one to two, maybe three at most anesthetic experiences prior to obtaining the 1303 permit. And we kind of feel that that's appropriate for Arizona to follow suit in such manner to where we would lower the 20 case requirement to, I'd like to see it at 1 to 2, but a maximum of 3.
Okay, great. Thank you. Dr. Arnell.
I'm sorry. I had my hand up from the, I'll just say it now, but it's not related to this. 1304, that Jason sent out a corrected red line, because there was some old language. And then at the last time that we reviewed 1304, some of that got left out in the packet, and I was just wondering if the updated version that Jason just sent out is what we're looking at for 1304. But we can get to that later.
Great. So I guess, oh, let's see here. Dr. Lout.
Yeah, Randy had said IV. Isn't 1303 oral, enteral?
No, I said oral, 1303. I didn't say IV, yeah.
Okay. I thought you had said that earlier. No, okay.
I may have misspoke. Sorry about that, Dr. Lau, but yeah, I'm referring to the 1303 in particular.
Okay.
Dr. Snow.
So Randy, if you'll help me find out where we're talking, I see in, I think it's 1303, E. Number 2.
Unfortunately.
Is that what
you're talking? Yeah, I'm having trouble seeing my, here we go. I've enlarged my print here. What we're referring to is, I'm pretty confident we were saying 20 patients within, right here, 2A. Yes, there we go. Yeah.
So my question is a little bit maybe clarification more. So subsection E is initial applicants shall meet one of the following conditions. The first option is if you've completed 30 hours of recognized dental education within three years of submitting your permit application, then you only need to do those things, which says nothing of an amount of cases you have to do. Number two is if you completed that training more than 3 years ago and now you want to apply, now we're saying we prefer that they have shown 20 cases having been, you know, those 20 patients within the year, 75 patients in the last 5 years, just so that we know that they're kind of staying fresh on that material. This isn't for initial applicants who just came right out of a course and now are applying. What I read is this is for applicants who took a course, 3 years have lapsed, they didn't apply for a permit, and now they want to apply for a permit. Well, let's make sure they kind of know what they're doing, and that's established by having done these 20 cases.
Or they've come from another state. Or they've come from another state.
Right. Which I think those are two separate things, right? So if you're talking to someone right out of school, they want to get their 1303 permit, they follow subsection E1, and they get it. And in that E1, there's no defining number of sedation cases that they have to do. They just need to take a course that has letters A through E incorporated in that course, and they can submit their application and receive the permit. But if it's out of state or 3 years have passed since you've done that, then that's when we want to see that cases have been done since you took your course over 3 years ago.
Are we looking at the 1303 here? Is that what section we're in?
I think page 21.
Yes.
Yeah. 20 and 21.
Right. Heath?
Yeah.
You want to look at the pediatric endorsement. I think this right. is if you go the adult route.
Right.
We're talking about the pediatric endorsement. Initial application.
That's what I should have clarified. That was my problem, Heath. Yeah, I did not say the pediatric endorsement. That's what we were referring to.
Well, I guess my question would be if any committee members object to this new recommendation, and then if not, let's adopt it and move on. Dr. Lout.
I think three cases for a pediatric patient, somebody less than age 8, especially less than age 6, I think that's a little bit light. You know, you once you give the permit, the pediatric permit, I mean, people can treat 3- and 4-year-olds. I think you need a little bit more experience to treat the younger kids. I'm not opposed to not making it a high number like 20, but I think a little bit more than 3 would be appropriate for a pediatric patient.
Dr. Snell.
I would agree. I mean, if we're going to all this effort to include a section in each of these permit levels for pediatrics to protect the safety of those, especially those under 8 who are the most susceptible to potentially having adverse outcomes, wouldn't we want to stay in that same vein of we're showing that we're protecting them by if you want to do pediatric enteral sedation, totally fine. Let's just show that you have a really good understanding of that because they are the most vulnerable part of the population when it comes to sedation. I think if that stays consistent with wanting to put in pediatric endorsements, if we want to put in pediatric endorsement, I think it should show that you need to demonstrate some competence. And having done 3 cases, I don't know that demonstrates a lot of competence, especially for those that young age.
Dr. Brady.
ADA CDEL came out with their opinion on this and their guidelines that requires 60 hours of didactics and 20 cases. So that's their number.
Dr. Beanstalk, oh, you had your hand up.
Everybody said what I was going to say. I have to agree with Dr. Snell and Dr. Lout. 3 cases does not show enough competency, especially if we're going through the motions of protecting the public with this permit and pediatric endorsement. So I think it needs to be a little bit higher. But again, I'm not opposed to making it less than 20.
Dr. Blazer.
I think our question then comes in, where do we expect our doctors that are out of school to be able to obtain this type of training?
Dr. Blau.
No.
I'm sorry, Randy. I didn't tell you were done.
I am.
No, I think this could go back to some of our discussion in earlier meetings as far as, like, working, observe with the person that has the 1303 permit or somebody 1302P or 1301P or working with the dental anesthesiologist and oral surgeon that treats children. I think observing cases and being involved with those would go a long way in educating one. And I think that'd be a good way of going with the cases too. I think that would add to the number of cases, and I think it would be educational and it could tell you what not to do and appreciate the airway more and the size of the child and how much local anesthetic you give and all those things that are important with the pediatric dental patient.
Well, I would agree. A lot of those are great points, but I think in those scenarios, the observer is going to likely be observing cases that are more of a higher level than what they're going to do with an oral sedation. I'm not so sure we're teaching much oral sedation with those types of experiences, right? I mean, a dental anesthesiologist doesn't come in and do oral sedation, nor does a maxillofacial surgeon. So that's where I'm having a bit of a hard time understanding how someone out of a dental school is going to get their pediatric endorsement, you know, without having any kind of, a caseload. And that was how we got started on this topic of conversation, and hence our, you know, redirection afterwards with Dr. Caputo and I.
Does the clinical experience count if the applicant goes to another 1303 permit holder with a pediatric endorsement and observes them do cases?
I would think it does. Yeah.
Yeah, I would highly recommend that.
Yeah. Sharing
that's the way to learn.
And then it provides the potential applicant or the applicant with, you know, a pathway to getting some more cases, to meet whatever requirement we come up with. So if 3's too little and 20's too much, what's a compromise?
Oh, sorry.
we'll start off with Finn. Anthony, go ahead, and then Matt.
I think the challenge is the pathway. So is this going to be something that's the board provides to applicants? Is this something that the applicant just has to figure out on their own? I understand that people may be willing to provide some type of shadowing or other type of experience this way, but the applicant has to know how to get it. And I don't know that that's the board's requirement per se. I guess it could be, but then are we putting more requirement on the board to provide that? Or are we just saying to the applicant, it's up to you and you've got to figure it out, versus anybody else that goes through some type of permit training has a course that's clearly defined? And I think to Dr. Blazek's point, the two programs that currently teach pediatric oral sedation, they have clear guidelines that they meet the state requirements that have requirements out there. And no state, including California and Texas, which are some of the largest states where we provide anesthesia and sedation services, just in terms of numbers, don't have that type of requirement. I also want to be very careful in classifying this population as the most vulnerable or the most difficult or challenging, because they're just not. As Dr. Blazek identified in all the cases that were reviewed regarding adverse outcomes, none of them were pediatric. Our big challenges are with adults, and we need to be thoughtful about that. I'm not saying that this doesn't require its own level of training, but I think we need to be reasonable about it. And I also want to just to be very careful in how we say what we say. And even to Dr. Brady's point about ADA and CDAL, those requirements are clearly for moderate sedation. The ADA does not differentiate oral moderate sedation from IV moderate sedation. So they're saying if you're going to get moderate sedation training, regardless of the route that you administer, this is the threshold. And I get it. I don't have a problem with the ADA, but I think to be fair, it doesn't differentiate solely this pathway. And I just think that we need to be thoughtful about that. Thank you.
Okay. So we'll keep talking about this. I'd ask committee members to throw out a number they feel comfortable with, though, so that we can progress through this. Because I think everybody's pretty much on the same page. We just got to come up with a number that works. So Matt, go ahead.
You just want the number?
Yes.
I'll be honest. I'm okay with 20. I think there has to be some standard to provide sedation.
Lisa, you had your hand up. Do you want to comment?
What other states besides Texas have, do we know what other states have done? Like you mentioned California, Dr. Caputo. What's the requirement for them?
California is one.
Yeah, one.
Yeah. All right. Wow.
But in what context? I think without reading the actual
pediatric oral sedation
verbiage, we would have for it to just say one, there's got to be some context around that, because I can't imagine someone is saying, yeah, go ahead and give oral sedation to someone after having observed it once. I mean, there's got to be, and that doesn't even speak to the need to understand their responsibility for how to manage controlled substances properly, what kind of staffing and equipment they need. I mean, there's got to be some standard to this.
They have the other similar standards, and they do the 60-hour or didactic courses. So all the other stuff is similar to what we have, almost the same. But the requirement for the actual procedure is just one.
Yeah, Ryan. I would be interested to read the context of that saying just one.
Ryan, Dr. Caputo had mentioned if it's, I think he was articulating, is it a burden to staff to receive questions from licensees regarding how can I gain these clinical experiences? I can imagine staff is used to fielding calls about continuing education courses. Is that true?
Yeah, and I think Sherry's on. Sherry's probably better capable of answering the question than I am.
Hi, Ron.
Sherry, do you feel like it would be a burden to field a phone call from a licensee that asks, where do I gain these clinical experiences? And you would say, you know, you can observe a 1303 permit holder with a pediatric endorsement.
Right. Excuse me, Dr. Beanstalk, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, and then when they ask you that question, could you provide them with a list of doctors who are willing to be observed?
If we were provided with that list, yes, staff, we can certainly share that information with any licensee that calls inquiring on any information, as we do as with CE or anything along those lines. We provide that information to them.
Great. Thank you. Dr. Lau.
Yeah, I had an Excel spreadsheet of all the different states and their pediatric dental sedation requirements. And there are several that mimic the 60 hours of didactic in 20 cases. And there's also some that have various ranges from 5 to 15, things of that nature. I guess if you want a suggestion, I would probably say 60 hours of didactic in 10 cases.
Dr. Lau, you want to make that a motion?
Yeah, I make a motion that we go with 60 hours for a patient less than age 8. I make a motion that we go 60 hours of didactic training and 10 hours of cases, not 10, 10 cases either administer or observe by a 1303P provider.
Terrible second. So discussion, Heath and Lisa, you both had your hands up at one point.
I was going to make this suggestion to do 10 out, to do 10 cases by splitting the baby. So exactly what Dr.
We're splitting the baby.
Split the baby.
All right. Heath, any comment?
I can back that. I just have some discrepancies with Anthony, but they don't need to go into, let's just move forward.
Sherry, let's get a roll call.
Hero?
Yes.
Arnell?
Yes.
Guy?
Yes.
Beanstalk?
Yes.
Lasik?
Yes.
Brady?
Yeah.
Christensen?
Yes.
Lout?
Yes.
Snell?
Yes.
Motion passes, none opposed. Great. Randy, Anthony, thank you for your work on that. I think there was one more person that I'm forgetting, but appreciate you guys' effort on that. Jessica, why don't you move us back to where we stopped off last time?
Okay.
Dr. Brady.
Hey, yes. I just, there's some, just a few little discrepancies in the red lines, but I'll help navigate us through that once we get to the 1304 permit. We did in March go through this quite extensively. The entire meeting was on the 1304, and then we circled back for a couple of those revisions. So are we taking the time right now to go back through everything on the 1304 again, or just to clean up the differences between that last meeting and today?
Jessica, you want to answer that?
It's really up to the committee. There's some questions that we have here in 1304, some suggestions for replacement language. So we can either go through the comments or go through the language line by line. It's just what you guys want to do.
I think what we've been doing is just kind of cleaning up wherever there was some outstanding questions. Because I agree with Dr. Brady. I mean, we spent a whole meeting on this. I don't think we need to go line by line. Let's just clean up the outstanding language and move on. Dr. Rout, you've got your hand up, but I don't know if that was from.
No, it's not relevant right now. I was just saying that there's a lot of available courses for the 60 hours of didactic. So that's all I was going to say.
Oh, great. Thank you. Sorry if I missed that.
No problem.
Ollie.
Hey, yeah, those, I apologize. I was in the car for most of the beginning of the meeting, so, but now I'm here at my desk with full attention. But the language that's here in the packet is very different from what was reviewed before. I actually went back and listened to that meeting because I was pretty confused because of this language being so different. So in my opinion, and I guess we could have a vote on it, but I would think that we should be reviewing the new language from Dr. Brady and not even looking at this hodgepodge that we have here, because Dr. Brady has basically brand new 1304 language, which is basically went back to the basics, and then we spent, you know, a couple hours reviewing it. So I'd be in favor of not bothering with what's here and using what Dr. Brady had.
Dr. Arnell.
Yeah, we, so I went back and I listened to this whole meeting as well and looked for discrepancies in what we had, what was sent out the other day and what we talked about that meeting. And I found six and sent those on to Jason. I think Jason put them in and sent them to Yasmin. So I think there is a cleaned up version somewhere.
If you want me to, I can, maybe we can just kind of walk through it real quick.
I do still
it
have
may save a lot of time.
Yeah, let's do that, Dr. Brady.
I do still have that list of six things as well, too, if that helps.
Perfect. So, you know, one of the things, maybe I'll have Matt say it, but I know the one big thing that's glaring out there is that at the very first part of it, Section 1301 mobile permit holder meets the requirements as specified by, and then where it says 1302, everything that says and is limited to the level of sedation allowed by that is struck out. That wasn't in my language with my 1304 draft.
So I think what you're saying is removing this red line of A2 through 4.
Yes.
Okay.
And Matt, if you want to just kind of guide them through the other ones, I just want to pull up my original 1304 and make sure I'm not missing something else.
Yeah, and actually that was good. The one that you just mentioned, I didn't catch because all there is audio. So I was just listening to the audio, and since nothing was said about that particular piece, then I didn't catch that one. So the first one that I caught, let's see, it was paragraph 2A. We either need to add functioning or remove properly. It's a very small edit.
So we still need to add language about the pediatric endorsement, correct? So that it matches where we've put pediatric endorsement in the other rules, or we're not having a pediatric endorsement for 1304.
Yeah, we do have a pediatric
endorsement. You don't need a pediatric endorsement for 1304 because the 1304 is going to bring a provider in. The provider has the 1304, has the pediatric endorsement.
No, Randy, even you and I need a pediatric endorsement. So does we've talked about this at length there. All permits have a pediatric endorsement.
The 1304 is they're going to employ somebody who already has the pediatric endorsement, in my opinion. So I think it's excessive language. You don't need it. Because the 1304 permit holder, they're hiring the dental anesthesiologist or the CRNA to come in or the MDA. That's my opinion. I thought we did not say the 1304 needed one. Dr. Lout, I think, is probably best to comment to this concept.
But see, Randy, why would I need one then?
Because you have a 1301. You're providing the anesthesia. the 1304 permit, they're not providing the anesthesia. They're working with an anesthesiologist.
Ollie.
Yeah, I was going to say something along the lines of Dr. Blazek. You know, the qualifications of the dentists for the pediatric population doesn't matter as much as the person they bring in. You know, we could give a 1304P designation to a general dentist, and then he brings in a CRNA or physician anesthesiologist that doesn't actually take care of pediatric patients, right? So now you're in this situation where you've granted the P to the dentist, but the person who's actually doing the anesthesia doesn't normally care for pediatric patients. My thought would be to, you know, make things equal, to put something in there that's not necessarily a P designation, but perhaps something that basically says that for a dentist to treat patients 8 years and under, they must ensure that the provider they bring in meets the same qualifications that we have for a P designation in 1301.
Dr. Lau?
I think there's two ways to look at that. If we're going to be consistent with all the other permits, then we have a 1304P. But I understand Randy's point that, you know, the person in the office, the dentist that's providing care, may not, you know, need to go through all that, that stuff to get all the hours and things like that. So, I mean, it can go either which way. I think if I was to lean towards an opinion, I would go with the 1304P.
Jason.
I think what happens is the confusion with the 1304P is that the, having multiple permits for someone that's like a 1302 and wants to bring in a 1304 to do the PEDS. And so and it goes to Ollie's point too, that we just have to make sure that they are meeting those same standards. So, you know, maybe it's, you call it 1304P, but it's more of an attestation form that they're making sure that whoever they're working with meets those same standards.
I like that idea.
I agree. That's better put. Thank you, Jason.
Jessica, are you able to take that comment and articulate it on paper?
Yes. So I think what I'm hearing is that you do want to have a pediatric endorsement for a 1304 permit, but it's essentially just the dentist who's applying for the 1304 pediatric endorsement is attesting that the non-dental anesthesia provider that they are using meets essentially the same requirements for providing anesthesia that we would require from a dental anesthesia provider under one of the other pediatric endorsement sections.
Correct.
Okay. And then I had another question here related to that, which is, what about staffing requirements? I think in the other pediatric endorsement sections for the other permits, we had certain requirements of having certain staff with certain qualifications in office. And then there were some questions here, too, from Dr. Brady. Not sure if those are still relevant or not.
I think that those are not. I think we answered them from that other meeting. Yeah, all of that is kind of verbiage before we had that meeting. So all that those comments could be taken out.
Okay.
Thanks. I think it's a little further down, but to Jessica's question about the staff, the last time we discussed this section back at the March meeting, there was a question that came up about how often a 1304 permit holder brings in anesthesia and is doing cases. And we were talking that if it's an office that routinely does it, that staff requirement that we have in other sections would be a staff member provided by the office, but if it's a dentist office that rarely is doing them, and I don't think we ever figured out what rarely means, how many cases a year, then the anesthesia provider would bring in a staff member.
Dr. Arnell.
Yeah, Aliyah, that's correct. In listening to it, the committee decided that the office either meets the currency as defined by the board, or if they don't meet the currency, then the anesthesia provider brings a staff member with them to treat.
And is that?
It was kind of like an either or option, right? Either they meet
the currency. Right. Yeah, I just wondered that if you that's what I remember from the call, and just trying to see if it's in this.
Yeah, we were supposed to put it in 1301. And so everything that Jason wrote references the standards of 1301. So we were supposed to put the either or option in 1301. Either the office meets currency or the anesthesia provider brings the additional, you know, assistant. We're supposed to put that in 1301 so that 1304 can just reference that standard in 1301.
That's correct. It also captures a dentist anesthesiologist working with someone that just doesn't do it that often in their office.
Yeah.
So did that get added to 1301 yet?
No, that has not. I do not think that that has taken place.
So Jessica, can we have some sort of note to make sure we add something like that into 1301 so we can reference it in 1304?
Yes.
Yeah, the either or option.
Yeah, I think that makes good sense.
And if Jessica, if you want to listen to that discussion, it's in the audio from 3:28 at minute 42 to minute 47.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. The last question that I had here, can the non-dentist anesthesia provider be another dentist? And I think the answer to that question is yes, but then they wouldn't be operating under this 1304. They would just be operating under their own 1301 or 1302 or 1303.
Correct.
Okay. And then finally, do we need to define the non-dentist anesthesia provider as someone who is licensed and/or certified to provide anesthesia services?
So should 1602 be signed into law? This is Ali Begay. All CRNAs, physician anesthesiologists, and DO anesthesiologists would have to register with their respective boards. So my thought would be, it hasn't been signed by Hobbs, so we can't know for sure. But I think we have to reference in 1304 that the non-dentist anesthesia providers is registered with their respective boards. But it's hard to put that in here now when it hasn't been signed while it's sitting on the governor's desk. But that could be a good way to define them by the fact that they're registered with their boards.
So I can leave this comment in here, so that we address it at a later date,
okay,
if that legislation is passed.
Yeah, it passed through the Senate and the House with pretty heavy support. Just needs to be signed by the governor, and the governor sure has been vetoing a lot of bills, so who knows what she'll decide to do.
Well, and after tomorrow, if it's not signed, it goes into law after 5 days. So, yes, the sign or veto, or it goes into law.
If I can jump in real quick, this is Ryan. I can't see exactly what you're writing, Jessica, because my vision is terrible, but can we just make a note of what Ali was saying? Because I wouldn't say it's for sure a thing that she's going to sign it. She has vetoed a lot, but this is not a super controversial bill. I know it drew a lot of controversy, but the way it ended up, I think there's a lot of support behind it and not any opposition, or not much opposition, if any opposition. So it would be good to note it that way, because I think that's probably the best way to define it.
Got it. Okay. And then it looks like that brings us then to back to Dr. Brady for the regular rule language itself. Was there anything that was missing in the rest of subsection A?
Yes, there's go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to turn it over to Matt because he went through this pretty much with a fine-tuned comb to audit what's there and what that mean held. So it'll be more of a resource here.
So the last, thank you, Jason. The last one that I saw in 1304A is under, let's see. I wrote here 1304A5, but now that's gone. So that was taken care of. Sorry about that.
Okay. All right. It sounds like then we can move on to subsection B.
I didn't see anything wrong with subsection B. And let's see. Actually, the next thing that I found wrong was section 1304H is completely missing. And there's a lot of stricken language in here, or there was when I first looked at it, that needs to be removed, but we can see that it's stricken. I think H was the next section that needed to be looked at.
Okay. I think I did have a question here. About a session that needed to possibly be removed. Yeah, right here. Maintain proper documentation of controlled substances that includes a perpetual inventory log showing the receipt, administration, dispensing, and destruction of controlled substances. Maintain proper storage of controlled substances in a safe or securely locked cabinet of substantial construction. And there's just a question here, should this be removed?
Yeah, I think the question would be globally, because that's a DEA regulation.
Right. I think the way we have it written in the 1301 permit is more appropriate, where we essentially say that the individual is responsible for following the laws of the DEA. So.
I would just suggest putting the same language there. You know, the dentist is responsible for whatever that we said in 1301.
I agree. Yes.
Yeah, I believe we did remove that, but it wasn't in the audio, so I didn't catch that one. I think that was removed before that meeting, actually.
Okay. And then you said H, I believe.
Yes.
So we're still okay then? So 13, all of this other language that's being added and removed before we get to H?
Yes. So I can't actually speak to that, because if it wasn't spoken, I didn't, you know, I wasn't aware of it. So I don't believe any of this red that you're showing here was spoken. And Jason, can you tell us, was this something that you had in your draft, or was this left over from before?
I'm looking now. Let me just get my orientation with it. It's,
While Jason's looking at that,
I think that's all.
Good. The DEA thing, what it says now, regarding the controlled drugs, it says now in 1301, is it just says, maintain a current permit to prescribe and administer controlled substances in this state, issued by the United States Drug Enforcement Administration. So I don't think the stuff about SORB should be deleted without replacing it with that.
Correct.
Yeah, I agree. So all this stuff was changed to be a pointer, so you didn't even have to list out all this. I think all this is just gone.
I think you're right. I think it just references 1301.
Correct. Yep, I see it right here. That is all taken out. And then do you see where it says maintain status, supervised personnel?
I do not.
Let me see. This is going to be, I'm a little bit lost on this.
We're in subsection H.
A little bit, Jessica, it's kind of the middle of page 25, what Dr. Brady's referencing, but the maintain staff of supervised personnel specified in R411-1301.
Oh, yeah. If this says that, then we're good. I just wanted to check that. That's all. So we're good. We're good.
Okay.
Yeah. And then it just almost goes to the very end, of 1304. Let me just take a look at that one. And then Matt, chime in too if there's something else. Yeah, I believe we have that then. Scroll down just a touch more to the next page. Okay.
And then essentially, here's the pediatric endorsement information. In order to treat a patient who is less than 8 years of age, the Section 1304 permit holder shall ensure the non-dentist anesthesia provider has met the requirements under 1301. Now, one of the difficulties in just referencing 1301 is that 1301 is a dental provider. So the qualifications that you have under 1301 for them to treat pediatric patients is going to be different than what's required of a non-dentist anesthesia provider in order to treat children 8 years of age or younger.
So you're talking about Section H that said the Section 1304 permit holder must ensure that the non-dental anesthesia provider meets or exceeds the non-educational requirements and restrictions of a 1301 permit holder. Is that what you're referencing?
right, because they're not going, they're, a 1301 permit holder with a pediatric endorsement is going to have certain things that are required of them because they are your licensee. They're a dental provider, which is going to be different than what is required from a non-dentist anesthesia provider.
Yeah, we spoke about that at length on the 28th, and what we decided was that the idea is that this section says that they have the same requirements for all of the equipment, staffing, so on, all the things that are outside of their education. And we just needed to massage the language so that there weren't possible misunderstandings like the one that you just brought up.
Okay.
So in essence, it just means the 1304, or that, the 1304 permit holder just ensures that this provider follows the requirements that a 1301 permit holder would follow if they were to, you know, come into their office. Not talking about, for example, we can't mandate that they, you know, have certain CE, like we're mandating the human simulation and things like that. All the non-educational things like the equipment, the drugs, the staffing, all of that has to be the same.
Okay.
I may be the only one that's really confused with all this, but this version that was emailed out to us, there's significant things in here, like that, all the way back to section B. I know we're all the way down to H. There's a lot of red added in here, like B5 defines physician anesthesiologist CRNA. But then subsection C of B5, it talks about the 1301, 1302, and 1303, which I don't even know why would that be in there? Because this is only for non-dentist anesthesia providers. So I don't know why that section's in there. Section C, it says added in red and highlighted in red, the requirement for an on-site evaluation may be waived by the board if the applicant attests to exclusively employ or work with a physician anesthesiologist or CRNA recognized by the board with a class 4 sedation anesthesia certification. I know Ali has said multiple times that class 4 and all that stuff was were things that he added a long time ago that we all decided to get rid of. So anyway, I'm feeling like I am not following at all what Jason had proposed and what is written in this version that we got emailed to us to be able to adequately follow what's going to be in the final draft, if you will.
Yeah, this is Jason. Sorry, just chiming in, but that was my whole thing. I was trying to get ahead of the wave because we noticed that very early on. And so we've got kind of a mix of a ton of red lines. And so the document really needs to really be cleaned up. So it's just showing like the change that we had made and looked at and all kind of agreed upon in that March meeting.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I'll even go further. I went back to and read section 1302, and there's several things in there in the document that was emailed out to us that I felt like we had discussed and changed things. I was focusing on 1302 because I felt like that's what I'm kind of representing as far as this committee. So I don't know if somehow this got an older version of things that got sent out or what, but there's a few things in this particular document that I feel like we have edited from discussions in the past that don't show that aren't accurate with what we've had discussions in the past.
I think for 1304, we can clean it up pretty quick, but it does need to be cleaned up. The sections that need to be removed, we can do pretty quick, but we may need to just sit down at a table and do it outside of this meeting.
Ollie. Yeah, I mean, Dr. Snell, I mean, it's incredibly frustrating for me because since December I've been saying that section's a hodgepodge of different paths that we were going. I had sent out a clean version. It never made it to the document. And then Dr. Brady created a new version that we discussed in the committee. And here we are. We still have this hodgepodge in here. So I don't know how we
can do that,
because if we talk about every meeting, people have done things to try and do it. And then we come back where we're supposed to be making decisions. And it's still in front of us. So I don't know.
I agree. Yeah.
So Heath, this section or this document that we're looking at right now, I mean, we can start here and it won't be too complicated. A lot of the things that you mentioned are this long list right at the end that just all needs to be removed. That was the last thing that I noticed. And once that's done, it should be pretty straightforward, I would think. But the way to do it is we need to take Dr. Brady's original version that he sent out, sit with it, with the audio from the 28th and with this document, and just make sure that we cross all the T's and dot the I's.
Yeah, but there were some things from that meeting on the 28th that weren't resolved that we need to be able to talk through. And a lot of it was regarding the unknown of 1602. With that,
yeah, I think
nearing completion now kind of changes a little bit of how you go through. But I agree, it's with, you know, we can take Dr. Brady's language, I think was, you know, more than 95% of the way there. We just need to go through that, not talk about what we went through with that while we're looking at something different.
Yeah,
and that's what I might have suggested. Is there any way to pull up Dr. Brady's version on the screen and let's just redline that, since we've already kind of discussed it, 95% agreed with it, rather than going through all of this, let's just take what he has, edit that, and then we can transpose that into as the new section 1304.
So do you want to delete then all of this language here that's new? Attesting that any anesthetization provider utilized meets one of the following professional categories and will maintain documentation of qualifications?
I think we could probably cut what Dr. Brady has, take his document, cut and paste that into the 1304 section, because he basically started from scratch with what the language was and made adjustments based on all the things that we've talked about over the years. I think it'd be a lot cleaner if we just take his, delete all of this, because his is based off the original 1304, where this is like three different versions with other ideas worked in that just creates such a hodgepodge that trying to get through it while looking at this, I think is going to waste a lot of time. Where if we could just take Dr. Brady's and go through that and then put that into 1304, we're going to save ourselves a lot of time.
Yeah, I think if we're going to make progress today, we have to do that.
And we just got word that 1602 was signed.
Oh, there you go.
Randy.
I was raising my hand to agree. So I looked for a thumbs up, but it was an option. It was no option.
So, Jessica, are you able to pull Dr. Brady's report up?
Give me just a second.
And just real quickly, if you're able to get the one that we worked on March, because very minor changes, but there were some changes in there that I don't have captured on my document. But I think we can like rediscover those pretty quickly. The reason I say we can rediscover those really quickly is because Matt's already listened through the whole entire meeting again. And earmark exactly where that was. So it may help just make this more current.
Yeah, thanks, Anthony. One question I had, probably for Anthony would be best. Is there, just because in this particular document, there's some errors as far as references and stuff go in the 1302, minor things that need to be made. Is there going to be a chance for us to kind of review a final fresh document and then any minor tweaks that any of us see, we can kind of edit those out just to make sure that it is as 100% accurate as we can get it?
So what I'm hoping for is that we can go through 1304 today. We have a hard stop in about hour and a half for another board committee meeting. But if we can get through the 1304 today, then our last scheduled committee meeting, we can kind of do one final cleanup and then still hit the deadline that 1602 has imposed on us.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
May I suggest real quickly, can you scroll through this? And Matt, can you look at the timestamps that you have just to make sure that this one has captured those things that you've identified? Matthew, were you
Oh, I'm sorry. Right? I was talking to a muted microphone. I wish that I could do that really easily, but when I went through it, what I was trying to do was correct the document that got sent out as opposed to looking at yours and listening to what.
Oh, so I guess my other question might be really easy to know. If Jessica, is this the one that we've looked at? Is this post modifications from that meeting date? So we could probably look at the date last modified on this file to see.
I believe so.
Okay. Then let's just run with this then.
And I think I'll remember, although I don't have everything written down, I listened to it in a lot of detail. I'll remember where a lot of things were discussed and so on. And I do have some notes on that discussion.
So a couple of things we need to add in there was just the how we handle the P's, because we just did that in there, and also whatever else we did before here. Sorry.
Is there a way to make this bigger on the screen? It is so tiny. Is anyone else having a hard time reading that?
I was going to ask the same thing.
Yes, I've been struggling with it. And then I have my Surface. I can enlarge it, but then it's all blurry.
You're not supposed to look at it on your iWatches.
Oh, that's better. Thank you.
Okay. Ali, was there something that we can kind of identify to go through with this? Are there concerns?
Yeah, I was kind of wanted to just read through it and kind of refresh, because I never received this to actually go and read it outside of the meetings. I know one of the areas where gave me concern was regarding the on-site evaluation. I know you had put in here, Dr. Brady, about the temporary. Can we go to that section about the obtaining the permit? So we had quite a discussion at that March meeting about obtaining the permit and the temporary permit being issued. And so, you know, there wasn't much to say at that point while 1602 was kind of hanging out there. You know, one piece of 1602 is that the committee needs to create equitable access for all qualified anesthesia providers and improve access to dental anesthesia services. So right now, a dentist who doesn't have a permit at all can bring in a mobile permit holder, right? So my thought would be in 1304, you know, since a dentist can use a mobile permit and there's nothing in rule regarding that, but we want to make sure the dental board has some control over dental offices. You know, what I'd love to see, is that language that was in the other hodgepodge, something along the lines that the on-site evaluation could be waived as long as the dentist is utilizing a non-dentist anesthesia provider who is registered with their licensing board.
The problem with that is that there's no way for us to ensure standards at all. I mean, the medical board or the nursing board has whatever standards they're going to have. Like the 1304 permit is going to make them attest that who they're working with has those same standards.
Right.
So, you know, that's where I was trying to bridge in that temporary permit for these providers, because they're a known entity, right? The dentist has gone through that vetting mechanism of what their team looks like. I guess the problem is if you like dismiss it, if they work with this person, they don't need this permit at all. I don't think that works unless you're saying that it's just a temporary hold for them or the dental board itself. And the dentist needs to understand that who they're bringing on with their team to those standards that are represented that we've outlined. So I don't quite understand the request.
Well, it's that same issue that I mentioned in the last call, right? You're setting these standards, right? The standards must be followed. But really the person that ends up responsible for making the standards are followed is whoever this person brings in. So if you have an on-site evaluation, so let's say forget about the temporary. If someone just they get an on-site evaluation. My group comes in, brings in all of our equipment. They see that we're meeting the standards. That dentist then gets that permit and they can turn around and bring in somebody else that wasn't there when the evaluation was done. Now, I believe that person should still be meeting the standards because every non-dentist anesthesia provider who's working in dental offices is going to have to register with their boards and attest that they're meeting the requirements for safely administering anesthesia in a dental office. So there are checks and balances to make sure that those standards are being followed. When you look at it on the other side, right, if the on-site evaluation is in one dental office, you get an office that doesn't have a permit and brings in a mobile permit holder. How's the dental board ensuring that that office is meeting the standards within it?
Dr. Blazek, you started speaking at one point. Did you want to go?
Well, yeah, I kind of lost my train of thought there, but my response to Ali on that, I think, is where our concern is that the dental board has the oversight of the MDA, or sorry, the dental anesthesiologist who you know, follows those rules and regulations about when they go to an office, they verify that the office is properly equipped or set up. I think our concern is, in your scenario, we don't have any oversight on that. Now, is that where you think your board is going to step in and kind of follow suit or follow in a similar fashion based on the 1602?
Yeah, in my discussions with board members is that the requirements that are going to come from at least the nursing board, and I'm sure the MD and osteopathic boards will do the same, will mirror the requirements of the dental board. Because, I mean, when you really think about it, the rules that we have here are their standard of care. The standard of care in anesthesia is the standard of care in anesthesia, no matter who is administering the drugs.
Dr. Arnell.
So, Ali, we spent a lot of time talking about this on the 28th, and in the end, the committee decided that there is a need for the on-site evaluation. And what Jason was trying to do was to help you out to make that easier, to have the temporary for known providers. And the committee agreed that was a good solution. And, you know, if we start saying that an on-site evaluation is not necessary for you, it becomes very hard to say it's necessary for me or for Lout or for anybody. But the temporary is helpful in that if that provider that they're bringing in has already been working in offices where the site evaluation was passed, that you can rapidly provide service to that office and do the site evaluation afterwards. Anyway, I guess what I was trying to say is
it's a checks and balance issue for the dentist to go get the 1304 permit. We're not requiring too much for the dentist to do this, to know what his team is, and ensure that they know that the requirements that are in place for the standards and rules that we have met, that is met with their team. I mean, I don't know how else we can go around in circles with this. Like, someone has to be accountable in the dental office, and the dental board needs to be able to govern who that dentist is and everything that takes place in a dental office. I mean, it's really that simple to me. But we're here at the 11th hour pulling away the 1304 permit all over again. It's just getting frustrating.
I think we need to move on.
Yeah, we already agreed on this.
At our last meeting, we can vote on all of it, and if there's dissension, then we'll address it. But if majority agrees that this is what needs to be done, then we can move on. And I think we're going to talk in circles right now. I think we should move forward with the rest of the 1304 language.
Could I just say one last thing, Dr. Hero?
Yes.
So I'm not saying to remove 1304 permits altogether. That's not what I'm suggesting, because I completely agree the dental board needs to be able to regulate dentists. What I am saying is that if a dentist that a non-dentist anesthesia provider utilizes those services, and that person is registered with their respective boards, and that dentist needs to get a permit, and including the on-site evaluation, versus when a dentist anesthesia provider comes in with a mobile permit to an office that doesn't have any 1304 permit in place, that doesn't seem like equitable access to all qualified providers to me. I really appreciate what you did, Dr. Brady, with the temporary, and Dr. Arnell, with the temporary. I think that could be a good fix. It isn't quite equitable. So I wasn't suggesting the 1304 go away. I was just saying that the on-site evaluation ends up being an extra process that needs to be coordinated by the dental board. And it really doesn't do anything to add safety, because you don't know which other non-dentist
guys, I'm so sorry to chime in. My daughter got hurt. I'm getting off this meeting. I'm telling you right now, this is as equitable as we possibly can make it. I know you're looking at speculations that your board is going to hold the same standards and echo the same standards, but they could change your mind. And it's speculation. And there's no assurance that the other boards are going to follow suit. Thank you, guys.
Hope your daughter's okay, Jason.
I hope she's doing okay, Jason.
Thank you, Jason. I hope she's okay. Let's, Jessica, move us forward, please. Dr. Arnell, are you okay to kind of cover this without Dr. Brady on?
Yes.
Okay. Then, Jessica, let's move us along.
Okay. So this was all based on the discussion for the new subsection D, which talks about a temporary Section 1304 permit. And then we get down into what is now the new subsection E, talking about the record for anesthesia and sedation for each procedure. And I think we get rid of a lot of subsection, what used to be the subsection D.
That's because it just references 1301. If you look at how he just references the standard in 1301, so you don't have to spell it all out.
Mm-hmm. And then getting rid of subsection E about intravenous access.
Yes, we voted to just remove that section since it's a standard of care.
And then you've got subsection F, ensuring that the physician, anesthesiologist, or CRNA utilizes supplemental continuous flow oxygen for patients receiving general anesthesia.
Can we scroll down and look at H, see if H is present? I believe that'll answer. If H is present, that'll answer your question on F. Yes, okay, H is in there as it should be. So F, I believe F is okay.
Okay. That brings us to 1305. Do we want to go through 1305 on this document or the main red line?
I think 1305 is, you know, kind of squashed. That was Ollie, I'll let you talk to that, but I know you came up with that language as like a potential alternative, but, I'm sorry. The adverse occurrences. I thought we were talking about that permit. So go ahead, Jessica.
So I wasn't, because you mentioned just taking this as a whole and replacing what was in the main red line draft with this language for 1304. Did you want to do the same thing with 1305, or did you want to return back to the main red line document for 1305?
We spent some time talking about adverse occurrence reports at the beginning of this meeting. So I would utilize whichever report is most in line with that discussion.
I think you have to use both, the original red line and what they just added.
Anthony, and then Heath.
Just two things real quick. I just didn't know if you guys wanted to have consistent language. I mean, you're saying non-dentist anesthesia provider, and then in F you referenced specifically a physician anesthesiologist or CRNA. So just a comment about consistent language. And then really what you could do with this 1305 is just do a substitution of what you all approved earlier in the meeting. I mean, you voted on it and approved it, so just put that language in.
Jessica, were you on at that point when we were discussing that?
No, I don't think so. I didn't hear you guys talk about anything with 1305.
So we didn't reference it as 1305, hence my confusion a few minutes ago. But we kind of had, in between this meeting and the last meeting, there was a breakout of a few committee members that reviewed adverse occurrences. And they provided some language, which at the beginning of this meeting we discussed, voted on, and approved. So that I don't know that that's going to replace everything in 1305, but it may answer some of the outstanding questions that we had previously. Heath, and then Ali.
So I think two things. One, I agree with Dr. Kudo there. It can just adopt it into 1305. And then for Jessica's sake, this main document, there's an added section 1305 in the main red line document that was sent out to us. I don't want to overspeak, but I think everyone is in agreement. You can just go ahead and remove that whole new section 1305 because it was Ali's well-doing many years ago to try to come up with something else, but it no longer pertains. So as you're going through that main document, just remove what's in there as 1305 and make the 1306 reports of adverse occurrences the 1305.
Okay.
Ali.
I was going to say the same thing as Dr. Snell, that in the board document, that new 1305 section can just be deleted. So the report of adverse occurrences goes back to being 1305. And the other thing I was going to say in us reviewing 1304 now, we just kind of skipped to that, the on-site piece, but do we need to talk about how a fee designation works, or is that covered in the 1304 language that's in front of us right here on the screen?
So do we want to, as we spoke earlier, do we want to just add a language that says that a licensee applying for a 1304 P designation attests that the provider that they bring in meets the requirements for a pediatric designation as defined in 1301?
I think that's the best way to do it. Did Dr. Brady already do that, though? I didn't have this actual document to review.
Yeah, what we're looking at right now, I don't see it in the view we are in right now, but I can't see the whole
thing. I did have a note in there to add in the pediatric language. It's not on this draft here. The pediatric language is actually on the main draft, I believe.
Okay. Do you have access to that?
I do. I can't show you both at the same time.
Okay. Well, as long as it's going to be taken care of, that's good. No,
can we just put a note that it gets added in? And then I think Anthony's point was correct. For F, we should change the language there.
To the end app?
Yeah, that's correct.
Mm-hmm.
That's it, yeah.
Okay.
So do we need to go back to the other document for 1305, or is that just, we're just going to go back to what we talked about earlier in the meeting and use that language?
I think we can go back to what we, I think we can use what we talked about earlier. The only nuance we need to change with 1602 is to change it from, transport with hospital admission to activation of EMS. That's, you know, minor detail.
Jessica, do you have a copy of that document that we were looking at earlier?
I don't believe I do.
Ryan, you want to send that to Jessica?
And Jessica, when you go to put it in, if you have any questions, I can clarify it for you really easily.
Okay.
As far as what that little change is.
Okay.
And Jessica, in between this meeting and the next meeting, will you review all the proposed changes this committee's making and review the new language in 1602 to make sure that nothing conflicts?
Sure. Okay. So do we need to review any of the 1305 language here?
I don't believe so.
I think we can go back to the committee packet.
Okay. Okay. So this will go back to the regular 1305 and then match it up with the discussion that you guys had earlier about reports of adverse occurrences.
Yes, the email that that Ryan is sending you has the new language for it. And then just get with me. There's one little detail that needs to be changed in the language to make it match 1602.
Okay.
And I forwarded it to you, Jessica, and copied Dr. Arnell. So if you need to reach out to Dr. Arnell, feel free to contact him directly.
Okay, thank you. And then still wanting to get rid of the regular 1306 rule completely, education continued competency.
I think that all of the education and continued competency basically has now been worked into 1301, 1302, 1303, and 1304. And I'm assuming that's why this whole section is redlined now, because it all kind of got put into mm-hmm. the appropriate settings. Am I right on that, everyone?
Yeah, I agree. I'll, yep.
So then would we want to remove the comment from Dr. Brady? If we're removing this section completely?
I believe the simulation requirement is put into the language already in the section 1301. Is that correct?
That's what I would assume. It's been so long, but that's where it needs to be.
I believe I just read that the other day. It should be there.
Then great. We can wait for the final product. All of us review it, and if it's not, add it.
Okay. Brings us to 1308, renewal, which is the old 1307, renewal of permit.
So on our document that I'm looking at, it redlines out section 1301, 02, 03 permit and switches it to level, which is again like 2 or 3 years ago that was in there that should have been changed out. So we'd want to go back to take out the level number of permits and go back to the section 1301, 02, 03 permits. And also, do we need to include the pediatric endorsement? Because that falls under each section. Does it need to be specifically outlined in that sentence there? Can it just, I mean, if you have a section 1301P, then is that separate than the 1301 that needs to be outlined here? Can you just, would it be sufficient just to say section 1301, 02, 03?
So I think you would need to spell it out in which case, in order to renew a pediatric endorsement, is it different than what's required to get one initially?
Hi, my name is Keisha, I'm a professional virtual nurse therapist. I was calling in regards.
Yes.
Yes, it's different to renew than it is a pediatric endorsement than it is to get one initially.
Correct.
And unless we've addressed those renewal requirements in the pediatric endorsement sections, then I would think that you would still need something here to say how they can get their pediatric endorsement renewed.
If it's not in those sections, you're correct. I know that there's been a discussion about seeing a sort of a finalized version to go through, and you might see that as you're doing the sort of final draft, Jessica, but you're correct. If it's not there, then it needs to be somewhere.
Yeah, I think you're right, Dr. Caputo. It's up earlier.
Okay. And then these are the requirements for the renewal of the permits. as I go through it and make, you know, edits and reorganize things, make sure that everything's consistent, make sure where you see language about, you know, level 4 permits is removed and stays as a section, you know, 1304 permit language.
Yep. Right.
Looks like... go ahead.
The renewal stuff looked accurate, as well as a comment.
And so I did have...
I'm wondering, Jeff, what about... Sorry, Jessica. In A1, 2, like, we just removed section 1306. So, number 1308, A1, and 2, that would no longer apply?
So I think section 1306... is still give me 1 second.
Hey, Jessica, I think in what's the new 1308, basically all of the red lines for permit renewal can be rejected other than one referencing the and pediatric endorsement. So it would go back to being 1307, get rid of the level 1, 2, 3, get rid of the reference to 1307 that should be 1306, get rid of the B3, get rid of the reference to R411-1305. That's all part of one path that we were going, like, I think, like 3 years ago.
My question is, if we just removed continued competency education, which is section 1306, we just redlined all of that and took it all out of the document, so it's not going to be in there anymore. How can we include A1 that says provide written documentation of compliance with the applicable continuing education requirements in R411-1306, as well as number 2, provide written documentation of compliance with the continued competency requirements in R411-1307? Aren't those completely wiped out with what we just did in the section above?
Yes. And I think it's because those education requirements were put into the various sections. They're no longer housed in one section together, if I'm not mistaken. So I think when you guys talked about getting rid of 1306 about the continued education, it was because all of those continuing education requirements were already addressed in other rules.
So would it make sense, Jessica, to get rid of this renewal of permit section and just add in each 1301 through 1304 its own little subsection at the end of each of those? It says renewal of 1301 permit, 1302 permit, and just put item number 3 here and item number 4.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's one way to do it. Because if I remember correctly, the language in those 1301 through 1304 permit, it was to obtain or renew a 1304 permit.
Yeah. And this just provides, and then you add a little thing at the end of each of those just to provide the timing of when applications need to be submitted for renewal.
So probably this language here, number 4, A4. Okay. And that's all we had in here. The rest are additional comments and questions from various committee members. And then I think at the very back end, we have some citations that were provided as well.
Heath.
Anthony, since we're to the end here and we have a little bit more time, can I go back to a couple things in 1302 that I think we talked about that didn't get changed, or do you prefer to?
No, I mean, if we can, I think the more we can get done right now, the better.
Okay. Let me hold on. Let me file back to.
I think we should wrap up in about 15 minutes, though.
So Jessica on page, this is actually, page 12. So this is in the 1301. But it pertains to 1302 as well. And maybe you're already on this, Jessica, and so you can just tell me that, but it just hasn't been changed yet. I know we talked about it. So on page 12, section H, talking about IO access, I know we had talked about changing that language because the way it's written would suggest that, like, you can only use or interpret it, I guess, is meaning. The IO access, that if yours is an emergency, only IO access would be allowed. So I know we talked about changing that verbiage, and the same phrase is in the 1302 permit as well.
Yeah, so the section 1302 permit holder shall use intraoffice access exclusively for emergency situations.
Okay, I didn't see that in my version. Sorry.
No, that's okay. And then I have a note here that says that it should match the 1301 language. It should only be used during emergency situations if a patient IV is not in place. That's accurate for all permit levels.
Okay, perfect. And then again, let's see, page 15.
Mm-hmm.
First thing is, I think at least on my version that I'm seeing that was emailed out, it says section C. And then the next edited section, it says C is crossed out and it has E. Is that what yours? Mm. So from then on my version, all those subsections are off by one letter.
Okay.
And then in that section, what is should be D but is E, 1B, this is for the committee. I have it says hands-on supervised, so this is for a 1302 permit, an initial applicant. You got to get 60 didactic hours and then have hands-on supervised personal administration of medications for parenteral moderate sedation to at least 20 patients in a manner consistent with this section in the presence of at least one permitted general anesthesia provider and the course director. Is that, I don't know if that's new language, if that's always been in there, but when I read that, I think of like myself, having done a residency at AEGD. Many of you know Dr. Ernie Luce. He speaks and lectures worldwide. He was my provider, anesthesia provider, but he's not a permitted general anesthesia provider. So do we want to take that out of there and just say in the presence of the course director or an anesthesia provider or anesthesia or sedation provider? I just don't know why it needs to be a general anesthesia provider for a 1302 permanent.
Do we know the original language?
I don't know if that was the original language. I can look it up. I have the one right now. Let me see.
Are you looking at subsection E, initial applicants shall meet one of the following conditions? Then you,
hands-on
supervised personal administration of medications for parenteral moderate sedation to at least 20 patients in a manner consistent with this section in the presence of at least one permitted general anesthesia provider and the course director?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
And right. I do have a note here that says define this term, the term being permitted general anesthesia provider, to clarify that the provider must be licensed or permitted to provide general anesthesia services and is in good standing with the regulatory entity that issued the license or the permit.
Yeah, I don't know why that would be in there personally, because I would say most of the courses that are taught and residencies that are given are not done with someone who is a permitted general anesthesia provider for parenteral moderate sedation.
Randy.
Well, my only comment would be if the previous language was less restrictive, I don't think we've ever had a problem. So let's go to the previous language.
So here's the previous language, Randy. It says, so you have one and one A is the same, 60 didact hours. And then B just says hands-on administration of parenteral sedative medications to at least 20 patients in a manner consistent with this section.
Then I would vote that we maintain that language. You know, because again, I think it's like an affidavit type thing. You know, we're asking the individual that's applying to show us that they've had adequate anesthesia training, and these are the requirements. And they say that they have, you know, to put the onus again on the applicant to verify the individual providing the training has a general anesthesia permit. I don't know if that's necessary. So I'd motion that we take that out or move to remove it.
I agree.
Yeah, I would just
the old language I think was better.
That's what I'd say. Jessica, I would just revert to the current language.
You know, I don't even think we need a formal motion. I think Jessica, you need to do that.
Mm-hmm. So, no longer needs to be supervised or personal administration, just hands-on, right?
That's what the current language says, yeah.
I do think we need to keep the strike on the parenteral sedative medications and use medications for parenteral moderate sedation, because that's how we've been referring to moderate sedation.
I think that's fine.
Okay. To at least 20 patients in a manner consistent with this section.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then skip down a couple pages to page 17.
Okay.
A minor edit in that first section, little a. It says that the equipment and supplies for the provision of parenteral moderate sedation as required in R411-1302, it said D, that should be B. And that same thing is referenced in little section little B right below it too.
Compliance of 1302D should actually be B as in boy?
Correct.
Okay.
And then what is letter I? Subsection I. Section 1302, permit holder for intravenous access shall use a new infusion set. And this would go for 1301 as well. It says a similar thing. I don't remember. I know we talked about it in 1304 that this was just kind of standard of care. So we took it out of the 1304. Do we want to be consistent with that for 1301 and 1302?
And you're talking here about the new subsection I, the permit holder for intravenous access, shall use a new infusion set, including a new infusion line and new bag of fluid for each patient?
Yeah, I know we just had that discussion for 1304, and we took it out, saying, reasoning being, that's about as normal standard of care as you can get. And so I don't care if it stays in or not, but if we're being trying to be consistent, it's not in 1304. Do we remove it from 1301 and 1302, which it still is in both of those sections?
Dr. Blaze,
Heath, what specifically are we talking about? I missed what you're talking about.
The 1302 subsection I on page 17 regarding using a new infusion set and infusion line and bag of fluid.
Oh yeah, we discussed that already in a meeting before and decided that that wasn't needed. I think we just said that we needed to match that everywhere else.
Yeah, okay.
I would actually mention Dr. Caputo's had his hand up quite some time, and I'll defer to him.
Oh, sorry.
Dr. Hero.
Dr. Caputo, go ahead.
I just wanted to make sure you all were aware of what you were doing when you said to revert back to the current language on the number of the course requirements. Most boards anymore are requiring that insertion of personal to emphasize that the trainee should be doing their own cases. So by taking personal out, what you're saying is that they could observe a case versus doing a case, and it doesn't say what number they should observe versus what number they should do. So just to make sure you're aware that you might want to reconsider using keeping personal in there. So thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Caputo. Sorry, I missed your hand.
I agree with Anthony. I think that's a great point.
I do, too. I see courses where two individuals team up, and between the two of them do 20, when in reality each one is really only doing 10, but because they're being observed, then they count it. But I don't know, is that what that means? Because to me, that's not even hands-on administration. To me, if you're observing, you're not doing hands-on administration. So by definition, I would interpret hands-on administration, which is the way it's currently written, to mean I need to have my hands on starting the IVs and doing stuff, not observing someone else doing that.
And my original reason why I was kind of agreeing with you, Dr. Snell, was more about removing just the licensed trainer, I guess, as how it was there. Not about that beginning part we removed, about personal. I thought personal should stay in as well as the hands-on, both. Hands-on personal administration, I think, is good. You know, and I'll talk about with the each patient should have a new IV bag and IV line. Again, I'm going to tell you the reason, and I've said this before, the reason that was in there is at the changing of the guard in the mid-2000s, there were still people out there mainlining patients, meaning a butterfly and a hubbed catheter on the end. And there were some difficult situations during an anesthetic evaluation, even renewals, where we're trying to tell them you can't do that, and they'd say, well, you know, why not? Certainly, it is a standard of care. I 100% agree with you. We have other documentation to support that is a standard of care, but that, in my mind, is why that was still in there. And I think you're comparing apples and oranges with a 1304 permit, because again, a 1304 permit holder is not doing anesthesia. They're hiring someone. The person they bring in, whether it's a CRNA, MDA, DA, or OMFS, we know the standard of care, and hence the standard of care is held to the permit that we have.
But so, Randy, don't you want to make sure, because the 1304 isn't for an OMF.
Nope.
It's for a non-dialysis bed, right? So don't you want to make sure if we want to, and I'm not arguing that we take it out or put it in, it doesn't matter to me, but I think it should be consistent, because a 1304 provider, if that's what if we can only regulate the dentists and what is going on in their office, then it should be consistent throughout, regardless of who's providing the anesthesia.
But, Heath, don't you think, let's say that happens, are you going to say it's the dentist's responsibility or it's the anesthesia provider's responsibility? And that's the whole impetus of the 1602.
And I agree. I think that's why it's challenging that when we first started, I was liking where we were going compared to what the law has kind of handcuffed us to do, that we can't regulate outside of a dentist to anyone else providing anesthesia. So that's hard to regulate that. So I would say we just keep it consistent so that the dentist, I mean, they're saying you got to provide all this materials, all these equipment, all these forms. If we want to be explicit in saying a 1301 or 02 provider has to have new infusions and new lines and continual intravenous access, then I feel like that should be the case for everyone. But
I see what you're saying.
Not that big of a deal.
Matt.
When we discussed this before, we changed that sentence to just say that each case needed a functional IV.
Is correct. What you
changed it to. And then also when we discussed it, Anthony Caputo made a comment that I thought was pretty valid. He said, in essence, when you start trying to define every little detail of what the standard of care is in rule, then it becomes hard to enforce things when they're not written in there. But if we stay out of trying to define what every little detail of the standard of care and rule is, then when they review the cases, they can just say, this falls out of the standard of care and here's the evidence for why. I think we get into trouble when we try to define every little detail of how someone should provide anesthesia, because it's impossible. There's textbooks of 1,000 pages or more that define that.
Thank you, Matt. I think we should remove it from this section and section 1301. Like I thought we had already agreed upon, but it's still in here. So I just wanted to make sure that it got removed, I guess.
Yeah.
Or maybe replaced with that, what you had better adequately said.
Yeah, we did agree on that. I think you're right. We should just change it to what we agreed on and make it uniform across all the permits.
Let's do it.
What was the agreed on language?
I think we said that, I don't remember the exact language, but it just said that each case would use a new IV in essence, right?
A functional. So the section 1302 permit holder for intravenous access shall use, and then a functional, whatever terminology you just said, Matt.
Yeah, I think it said that for every case, a functional IV would be established or something to that effect.
And you said that that's correct for 1301 and 1302 and 1303?
Not 3,
1304.
IV access. Yeah, 1301, 1302, 1304. A functional intravenous port?
Intravenous catheter, maybe.
For each patient?
And then last one, Anthony, and then I'm done. Is that okay? I know it's 4:33.
Yeah, let's do one more and then wrap up.
Okay. Last one, and it would just be, it just matches 1301. Let's see, 1301O talks about a 1301 permit holder being able to perform at the level of a 1302 permit. I was wondering if we wanted to include that here, which would be subsection O, that says a 1302 provider could provide the level of sedation at a 1303. Just to, again, consistency and to explicitly state that as a 1302 provider, I could do enteral moderate sedation. So it would just kind of mimic 1301 section O.
That you can do anesthetics level lower than what you're permitted for, basically.
Correct. So 1301 says, section 1301 permit holder may also administer parenteral moderate sedation or lower levels of sedation without obtaining a section 1302 permit. So something like that from an O2 permit holder to the O3.
Yeah, I think that'd be appropriate.
So you're saying move the new pediatric endorsement language that's here in section O down?
No. Section O of 1301.
Mm-hmm.
Not Q. O. So it starts out as section 1301 permit holder may also administer.
Mm-hmm.
If you just copied that and pasted it and then just said you would change 1301. So it would say a section 1302 permit holder may also administer enteral moderate sedation or lower levels of sedation without obtaining a section 1303 permit.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you, Jessica.
Yeah. And did I hear correctly, since we've gotten through the rest of the document, go ahead and clean up this main red line draft, and then we'll go through it as a final draft before you submit it to the board?
Yep. And Jessica, with 1602 passing and Haas signed it today, we have a deadline to present this to the full dental board September 1st, and we only have one more scheduled meeting. So, you know, I think that last meeting should just be a run through of everything, making sure that it's all consistent and nothing conflicts with 1602 or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who had their hand up first, Matt or Randy.
I'll let Matt go first.
Do we maybe need to set another date just in case? I mean, we've worked so hard, just in case there's a few house cleaning things or something, do we want to set another date?
So we could try to do one in July. I'm a little worried it's going to be difficult to get a quorum, and I don't know how quickly staff can pull that together. Ryan, Randy, I don't want to skip over you, but just for the sake of this question, because it's a good one, Ryan, do you want to speak to that point?
Okay. Yeah, so you might want to do one in July. We could do late July. And we could do a Tuesday or Friday, kind of just to stay consistent. But I'll leave that up to you. There's literally only one more meeting scheduled between now and the August board meeting, because the board does not have a September 1st meeting. The bill states that you have to have your recommendations to the full board on or before September 1st. You only have your August meeting next. I'll leave it up to you if you guys want to do that. The other thing that I would like to say, though, real quickly, Jessica, do you want me to send you the 1602 language to make certain that we're referencing correctly back to the statutory references that have been affected by 1602?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Randy.
My question was, I guess a request and a question. Obviously this will be circulated to all of us, early. We should try to read it as, you know, as quickly as possible and kind of identify areas of concern. But the question is, how do we bring up those areas of concern without a meeting? Or, I mean, can we just email back and say, hey, I have a question about this? As long as it goes to all of us, what's our opportunity to look at something, you know, that we feel is not adequately or accurately captured?
Randy, just for a point of clarification, you're speaking with the language in these rules that we've been going through?
Yes, the final, after the cleaned up document. Correct.
Well, the only opportunity to do that would really be at the next meeting. I've thought about the same thing Matt suggested, which, to go back to that, it would, I think also answer your question. If we were able to schedule one more meeting, it'd allow us to read, you know, the proposed final document, go through whatever changes we think it still needs, and then potentially have one more meeting to meet and discuss. But what's the group's thought on that? Ali.
Yeah, I think I'm thinking the same line as Dr. Hiro and Dr. Blazik, that another meeting probably would be good. But I think it'd be really nice if all the committee members could get both a copy of the current redline version and a copy of a clean version so that we can all really give it a good read so that when we have another meeting, it could be like a targeted meeting where we just focus on a couple of things that we might think need to be fixed. Or who knows, maybe we all get a clean version and nobody sees any issues and we can say everybody says it's good and then we could cancel a meeting, you know?
Well, good. Then Ryan, why don't you have staff send out a doodle for that last week in July? You know, or late in July with, you know, Tuesdays and Fridays.
Yeah.
Let's see what we can make happen.
That's what we were just talking about. We're just going to do that last Tuesday and Friday. And whatever the largest quorum is when the meeting will be.
Okay. That sounds good. All right. Great work, everybody. We got the end in sight. So we'll adjourn this meeting. Jessica, thanks again for all your help. Ryan and staff, let's plan 5 o'clock.
Okay, I'll see you in a bit.
All right, see you guys in a bit. Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks.